So this Saturday we had a picnic in the local park, in Huddard Park, and I was looking forward to it. And probably the biggest surprise for me was how lovely it was to sit and meditate underneath the trees. We had a relatively short meditation of 30 minutes, and the weather was good, insect population was down or asleep, and it was delightful to sit there. And after the sitting ended, during the middle, what I thought was going to be the middle of Dharma talk, someone pointed out that there was probably a falcon up in a tree watching us or meditating with us. So I talked a little bit about the forest, practicing in the forest as part of a very important part of Buddhist practice. And I was kind of inspired by that and thought that two things. One, that next year, maybe May or June next year, maybe we can organize do a one-day sitting up there in Huddard Park. There's parts of it, corners of it, where it feels pretty private. End of the road, people don't go there for various reasons. And we can go up there and do a one-day sitting, just do our sitting and walking practice up there. And I think there's something very valuable about practicing in a setting like that in the forest. And the other thing that inspired me to do was to continue the talk here today, that talk about the wilderness, the forest. One of our lineages, one of the roots of our particular practice here at IMS, we have a number of different roots coming from Asia to what we do here. And one of the roots is the Thai forest tradition. So the word forest is in the tradition itself, in the name. And some of the monastics, or I think all the monastics pretty much who come and teach for us, come out of that forest tradition. And ideally, they would spend much of their time living in the forest. And some of them, Ajahn Tanisaro, his forest is an avocado orchard in San Diego County. Ajahn Amaro, and he has a monastery up in Northern California, and it's kind of in the woods up there, but it's more like chaparral, oak, poison oak, woodland. And the nun who will come visit with us for about a week or so in the beginning of July, Ajahn Sundara, she also comes out of that forest tradition. And there has been historically a tension in Buddhism, not always, but occasionally, between the forest traditions, those monastics who go and practice deep in the forest, and those who stay in urban settings, those who live in the city. It seems that at least a number of times in Asia, in Southeast Asian history, when the Dharma, when the monastic communities were kind of on the decline for various reasons, the rulers of the times would go into the forest to find monks who were particularly wise and virtuous and with some deep attainments, and bring them back to the capital to help purify and restart the Buddhist traditions as it, you know, revive it. And you do find, even in the time of the Buddha, a strong emphasis in going into the woods, into the wilderness to practice. And it wasn't just because it was beautiful to do that. There are ancient poetry, some of the most ancient poetry of humankind, coming out of the Buddhist tradition, that extols the virtue of being in the woods, being out in nature, being in the wilderness. So there certainly was kind of an appreciation of the beauty of the wilderness, but there was also a great appreciation for its danger. And the wilderness in ancient times, apparently in India, for example, was considered to be a dangerous place, and people would often not go there because, you know, there were lots of dangers to be found there. So those people who went into the forest to practice were maybe somewhat intentionally going into places that were dangerous. And they would have to contend with those dangers. And part of their practice, part of their spiritual practice, spiritual cultivation, was contending with those dangers and those difficulties that come with living in the woods. It's probably one of these unfortunate things where people remember the golden age, you know, when they were young and practicing whatever, and every generation thinks back. But the number of us who are kind of my age now, I think back at the early, you know, 20, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, when people were starting this kind of practice, a lot of people went to Asia, or even the retreat centers here in this country were quite rustic and quite a challenge to be at. And now we have these state-of-the-art meditation centers that people sometimes confuse with a Hilton. And it's wonderful to have, you know, good lodging and healthy environments, clean environments and all that. But what's lost is the challenge of difficult circumstances to practice under. And what happens when the circumstances are too easy is that it's not so conducive for cultivating, developing the character, some of the inner qualities and inner strengths that are really invaluable for spiritual practice. A spiritual practice, if it's just about relaxing in some beautiful place, you know, it's a lot of people can feel happy. But if it's if you put yourself in situations where it's dangerous or challenging or impoverished, then and to contend with those circumstances, it brings forth a whole other aspect of a person's personality. And so it's often considered quite valuable. There is this poem, ancient Buddhist poem. When the thundering storm cloud roars out in the mist, and torrents of rain fill the paths of the birds, nestled in a mountain cave, the monk meditates. No greater contentment than this can be found. When along the rivers of tumbling flowers bloom, in winding wreaths adorned with verdant color, seated on the bank, happy, he meditates. No greater contentment than this can be found. When in the depths of night, in a lonely forest, the rain gods drizzle and the fanged beasts cry, nestled in a mountain cave, the monk meditates. No greater contentment than this can be found. When restraining himself and his discursive thoughts, dwelling in a hollow in the mountain's mists, devoid of fear, he meditates. No greater contentment than this can be found. When he is happy, rid of stain, waste, and grief, unobstructed, unencumbered, and unassailed, having ended all defilements, he meditates. No greater contentment than this can be found. So I think it's a beautiful image of this monastic sitting in the woods, sitting in a cave, sometimes with, you know, stormy conditions, and being quite safe, you know, kind of protected in this cave, and feeling quite content, at peace, I suppose, and no greater contentment than this. There was another poem composed in the time of the Buddha, and this is attributed to the great god Brahma. And he's talking to the Buddha. Sometimes the gods would come to the Buddha and compose songs or poems as a way of communicating with him, I guess. And the great god Brahma says, "Let the wilderness serve for your seat and bed, freed from fear and in the fearless released. In places where frightening serpents abide, lightning clashes and the rain god thunders, in the blinding darkness of the deepest night, there he sits, the monk who's vanquished his fear." And then the second verse, "Let the wilderness serve for your seat and bed. Go about, set free from the ties that bind. But if perchance you don't find there your bliss, then live in a group, but watch over yourself. Mindful, proceeding for alms from house to house, mindful, with guarded faculties and wise." So here's the out, you know, if the wilderness doesn't work for you, then by all means, you know, practice together in a group of people in an urban environment. But there's a kind of warning there. It says, but if you do that, watch over yourself carefully. I think sometimes we lower our guard in urban areas and groups like here, right? And we feel it's so safe. And hopefully it is safe here. But in terms of the kind of deep spiritual work, the kind of attentiveness to what goes on in the depths of our psyche and the subtle forms of attachment that it get tied to projection and transference and interpretation and fears of being disliked and fears of what we say and how it'll be received, and all these things get play itself out in the social environment. They come into play when we're in groups like this. And so you have to be very attentive so that this doesn't get in your way of finding your capacity for greater peace. One of the reasons why people will go into the woods to practice far from people is in order to experience some kind of distance from those kinds of social conditionings, partly to see through them or to find oneself independent from those social conditionings. It's really a marvelous thing to step outside of our conventional social reality, social conventions, to step into limbo, to step into kind of there's a word, it's called the anthropologist by the name of Turner had this wonderful word called the liminal space, thank you. And Turner argued that all major kind of, a lot of initiation rites, for example, in traditional societies involved going into kind of a liminal space, a space where some kind of ritual space, time and place, where the usual conventions of society are not operating. And something can happen there that's different than what can happen when we're always relating to each other in the normal ways. I remember when I lived in Japan, people didn't say this, but liminal space in public Japan was the public bathhouse, public sauna. And because there, the hierarchy that often exists in Japanese culture fell away, and everybody was there naked, except for maybe a towel around them in the sauna, all the guys, and they would relate to each other. The impression I had was as equals. But then they went out into the locker room, put on their clothes, and then suddenly all the differentiation, the social differences came into play again. So a liminal space to step into in order to get a different perspective of who we are. Maybe to see ourselves in a way we can't see ourselves if we're always in relationship to each other. In fact, I would argue that much of the suffering that people experience arises out of the, somehow or other, out of the relationships we have with each other, with other people. Things we want, relationships we want, things we don't want, hurts we have, expectations we have. There's a lot, a lot of desire goes into human relations, a lot of anger, a lot of many different things. And part of the kind of radical challenge of Buddhism to us is pointing us to that part of our psyche, that part of our heart or our being, where we can take refuge, where we can feel at peace, that is not tied to our relationship to other people. And for some people, that's a radical and very frightening message, that somehow we can find happiness is not tied to the people around us, to having something or not having something from people around us. And so going into the wilderness sometimes is entering this liminal space, this place freed from conventions, social conventions, in order to have a very different experience of ourselves. It's also a place, and in doing that, the mind can, for some people, it can optimize the conditions for their mind getting very still and to a kind of silence of the mind. For other people, it doesn't work, and it's better for them to practice in urban settings or together groups of people. The other thing that the wilderness does for people is that it calls forth a kind of radical simplicity. It's very difficult to go into the wilderness if all you can do is carry your own things. You can't bring your refrigerator and you can't bring your television. And I suppose there are people who do it. I see advertised television for your watch. You can just kind of you can't bring very much, and so it's a very simple life. And even to this day, in Thailand, when monastics go into the deep wilderness to meditate, they go with very, very little. They go with maybe a warm blanket, a few robes to wear. They go with an umbrella, this big umbrella, that has mosquito netting down the side, the drapes that kind of hangs down the side. And so you might have seen pictures of these monks, they're sitting, like, you know, meditating underneath these umbrellas, mosquito netting coming down. And then when it's time to sleep, they lay down inside the mosquito netting. And but if it rains, it's not big enough to lay down. Umbrellas, they can sit and stay more or less dry. And they have, sometimes they build little platforms to sit on. And that's it. You know, they have their bowls, and their begging bowls. They can't go that far away. There has to be some arrangement to get their daily food. So because they can't keep food overnight, monastics. So they have to be close enough to some kind of some people living in the woods, sometimes hunter-gatherers, sometimes forest hunters or farmers or something, subsistence deliverers, some place or small village where someone will take care of them in providing the food. Tanisara Bhikkhu talks about this, who's lived this kind of life. And he sometimes, he likes to talk about these forest monks and nuns as being hunter-gatherers, because they're not actually, by the rules, they're not allowed to farm. They're not allowed to take fruit from the trees, not allowed to cut trees or plants or dig in the ground. So they're really completely dependent on gathering, hunting and gathering for their food, but they can't touch either. So what he means by hunting and gathering is that they have to be somehow, they have to go find those kinds of situations where there are people who want to offer them their food every day. In order to do that, he says, the monastic has to be worthy of those offerings. People have to be inspired by the worthiness of this, so that these monastics have to live a life of purity and a life of practice, so people will feel like, oh yeah, I want to help these people. So I really want to see them flourish in their practice. Let me put some rice in their bowl. And so, it's kind of like stepping, not only outside of normal social conventions, but it's also stepping outside of the market economy and living a very different kind of lifestyle than is most people's experience. So it's learning to live a life of radical simplicity, which is a really beautiful thing, to have that capacity to know that you can be happy with just a sleeping bag and a backpack, as some of you maybe experienced as in your youths. Some of you still are youths, but some of you maybe still are in your backpacks. And another aspect of living in the woods is it requires a lot of sensitivity, a lot of mindfulness. Because if you're not mindful of what goes on around you, it could be your end. And there's lots of stories to this day of monks in Thailand, where I'm most familiar with these stories, encountering tigers. There's still a few tigers left in Thailand. And elephants, rhinoceros, snakes, animals which are somewhat dangerous. And so they have to contend with that. They deal with that. They have to somehow relate to that. So certainly being mindful and awake to what goes on is a very important part of just living in the woods. And then once you encounter these animals, there's a whole training on how you relate to them. And, there's a training, at least in Buddhist instructions, to relate to them with loving kindness. To relate to them with non-harming, with non-violence. So, and the idea is that the animal world responds to your vibes, to how you are. And you create a safe environment for yourself if you offer them this kind of wonderful qualities. And someone, I think it was at the picnic, told me a story, maybe they're here, about seeing a documentary about Thai monks in Thailand who were raising tigers. Because the tiger population is quite challenged in Thailand these days because of deforestation and all that. And so in order to protect and preserve the tiger population, this is a monastery, I guess, that has become a tiger ranch. And so these monks are raising tigers, maybe to release in the wilderness. And they're showing us in the movie this big tiger jumping up on 2 feet and up putting his hands on the shoulders of one of the monks and kind of being very playful. I guess young tigers are quite playful. And the reporter asks, aren't you afraid? something like that, and the monk says, I trust the tiger completely, and the tiger knows that, and so the tiger trusts me. So I can trust the tiger. So it's offering of trust. So maybe not all of us, you know, are convinced in the value of offering trust and loving kindness and non-harming to the threatening animals around us. But it's a strong, long belief in Buddhism that this is actually a very powerful thing to do. It's very important not to do this unless you could really do it. I believe it's Sharon Salzberg who tells a story of, you know, some vicious dog coming to bark at her, and maybe you'll correct me if I'm wrong, and then she started offering loving kindness, but, you know, maybe she hadn't been rusty or something. She was doing it by rote, I guess, the practice, and the dog bit her anyway. You hear reports from Thailand of meeting monks, nuns, who spent 20, 30, 40 years practicing loving kindness. And you feel a field of love, loving kindness, of compassion or care or something around them, you know, a long distance around them. Palpable, people say. And so maybe that's so. Maybe the animals can pick that up. So living in the wilderness, you're not only cultivating things like mindfulness, but you're cultivating other qualities also in order to survive there. One of the qualities you find a lot of references to is developing concentration in the face of danger. And you find monastics talk about sitting and meditating in the middle of the night and then hearing some loud animal walking close by. Or you are sitting doing walking meditation and suddenly a tiger appears on your walking path. And then continuing with meditation, sitting there and saying, okay. Sometimes you have these statements, like Ajahn Chah said, if I'm going to die, I want to die in the Dharma. This is a good way to die. So rather than running away or doing something, I say, okay, I'm just going to devote myself to the practice, and if I die, this will be a good death. So maybe you think it's foolish, but this is an attitude that some people will have in their Dharma practice. They're quite serious about it. It's kind of like, you know, a do or die kind of thing. They're really serious about trying to attain this place of peace that in the depths of their hearts. So they go into the wilderness to find this, to discover it. And so as the quotes that I read here, the poems, they talk about becoming fearless, becoming people who have nothing to fear, and discovering how that capacity of fearlessness by being in the woods. Some years ago, there was a woman who came to Vajrapani, a retreat we teach in August, in the Boulder Creek area up in the Redwoods there. And a lot of the retreatants will stay in tents. And she chose to put her tent kind of far away in the woods, far from everybody else. And she would come to interviews really tired. I'm really tired. It's hard for me to meditate. I'm so sleepy because I'm up most of the night. What's going on? Oh, there's all these animals walking around my tent. Well, you don't have to tent way out there. Why don't you come closer where there aren't so many animals? So, oh, no, then I wouldn't have to deal with my fear. And she was staying there in order to contend with her fear, in order to come to terms with it. I remember having that experience in the wilderness, in the backpacking, when I was 17 or so, a teenager by myself in the Big Sur National Wilderness. And I didn't have a tent, just had a sleeping bag, and I was trying to hike out, and it got dark, so I thought I might as well sleep. It was dangerous to walk the trail after it got dark, but I couldn't really see where I was putting my sleeping bag down. It was already so dark, but it wasn't going to roll over the cliff or anything. I knew that it was safe that way, and so I got in my sleeping bag, and my impression was the good part of the night there were these things walking around me. Very loud, Maybe the leaves were very dry, and so they made, But it sounded to me, I had no idea what it was. What do you think of that? I couldn't get up and leave because it was so too dark to leave. And so I stayed. And I didn't know about practicing fearlessness or loving kindness or concentration or any of those things. But here I am still. It was probably raccoons, is my guess. And there's also something. There's a tradition in Buddhism of practicing in some environment, whatever the environment is, and then leaving that environment to test your practice. So, if you've been practicing in a monastery for a long time, one way is you go into the wilderness by yourself for 2 months to test your practice, see how good your practice is, how good is your concentration, your capacity to stay equanimous. Or another way of testing it is you go into Bangkok. You go into the city. You come to Redwood City. And you test it here. Or you have the capacity to be peaceful here in Redwood City, so then you go to San Francisco. Or you go someplace else. But go some environment where it's a challenge for you. You don't just stay in an environment where it's peaceful and safe for you. You use a peaceful, safe environment to develop your practice, and then you kind of venture forth from there to test it, to develop it further. A lot of people, there's a long tradition in Buddhism of doing that because people can fool themselves as to the depth of their attainment, the depth of their maturation spiritually. And people will think that they're much more developed, much more resolved, they're much more committed, much more devoted to practice than they really are. And it's really tested when you go off in some different environment. You go home to be with your family at Christmas. You know, whatever. You know. And so to take that into account, you know, as you go back and forth in different environment, that is actually considered very healthy to go back and forth. Back and forth. There are people I've met in Thailand who would spend years practicing in very pristine, beautiful wilderness areas where it was relatively easy, to find a peaceful heart. And then they go to Bangkok, and they just fall apart. And their response, which to me seemed very sad, was to run back into the forests again, to the countryside. And as if that's where, you know, real practice is, and feel really satisfied with the peace they attain there. The idea is to bring it to Bangkok, or the equivalent, and develop it there also, find it there also, in whatever environment you're in. When I was first came to San Francisco Zen Center to practice there in San Francisco, in near downtown San Francisco, all asphalt and buildings and almost no trees. And I've been living in the country here in America mostly, and living quite rurally for a while. And a friend from that rural times came to visit me. And she said, you know, I could never live here. There's no nature here. And I said, no, nature is here too. If we divide up the world too much between what's human-made and the non-human world and say that only that's nature, then we're bifurcating the world too strongly. If we're going to find our peace and our well-being, we have to also find it in the asphalt. I'm not championing asphalt or saying it's a beautiful thing or a great thing. I think that we can do with a lot less. But to find our peace there also is also an important thing to do. So going back and forth, different environments at different times of phases of one's spiritual practice. Here in the West, we have a strong legacy of people championing the wilderness, certain people, especially white people, white Protestant people, championing the great virtues of being in the wilderness, and you know, Thoreau and people like that. And I actually like that kind of literature and like that kind of values. But it tends to be a little bit idyllic and a little bit romantic. What do you see in the Buddhist tradition when people extol the value of being in nature? They also very much talking about how dangerous it is to be there, and part of, you know, and how difficult it is. The great difficulty is not just idyllic and beautiful. There's malaria. You know, the quote that I read on Saturday, there were 20 people in the monastic group that went into the deep forest to practice, not exactly together, but not exactly apart either. And 5 of those 20 people got malaria and had to go to the hospital. So it's not to be kind of romantic about the wilderness that the Buddhists go in it, but it's said that wonderful place to cultivate practice, for all the reasons, many of the reasons you can think of and more, and the ones I've talked about, is to go into the wilderness and spend some time there practicing your meditation. And I hope that next year that we can set aside some time, a Saturday perhaps, to go to this very tame area of the wilderness of Huddard Park. And it is in the range of a mountain lion. So, you know, we'll have to be a little bit attentive, alert, and but then the Blue Jays will warn us. And the last thing I'll say is the longest that I've done this kind of wilderness practice was a month in Thailand, in one of the jungles there. And it wasn't, you know, completely off in the wilderness. It was in a forest monastery. And I had to follow a path for about 10, 15 minutes in the jungle down to this little kuti, it's called, little cabin, hut, that is on stilts, that's about 8 by 12 feet, maybe smaller than that, maybe 5 by 8 feet. It's kind of small. It has a little porch. And I would practice there all day, except when I would go and in the morning for the one meal a day, I would go in to where the kitchen was, and they'd serve people there, take a little walk in. But otherwise, I was deep in the jungles, and there was the monkeys, and there were snakes, and big snakes. Once I stepped on a snake that was as long as the road. I mean, the road was maybe 6, 7, 8 foot long, you know, and it was dusk, and I was just walking along, and as far as I knew, there was a branch across the road, and so I stepped on it, and I jumped faster than I've ever really jumped in my life, and I don't know what kind of snake it was, but I do know there were poisonous snakes in that jungle. And it was really lovely to be there in that jungle. And the way I did the practice was that I didn't do very much. I lived a very simple life. And when I first started the month, I would meditate for a few hours in the morning, and then go for my meal and come back, meditate a little bit longer. And then I would take it a little bit easy. I would just hang out. Sometimes I read a little Dharma book. Until it was evening, I'd sit a little bit more, and then I'd go to sleep. And then each day, I would meditate a little bit more. So I wasn't pushing myself to meditate as much as I could, as quickly as I could, but rather kind of a slow process of kind of easing into it, in a sense. By the middle of the retreat, I was meditating all day long and much of the evening. And just being there, either on the porch or being inside, depending on the mosquitoes and the temperature. And it was really a lovely place to be and practice. You find a number of things. You find your that kind of way you can find your own rhythms of practice. If you're always practicing in a group environment, you don't find your own rhythms. And you find your own resolve or determination or discipline. I had practiced for many years in the Zen tradition where we always practice as a group. In fact, in the Zen centers I practiced, there was actually a kind of a taboo of sorts against practicing alone. This was in the monastery because you're doing something special, kind of outside of what everybody else was doing. And you weren't supposed to kind of do anything kind of individualistic, kind of special or, you know, stand out or be more spiritual than other people, you know, have this Zen stink. And so you're supposed to, just follow along. So that's what I did. I just practiced with other people for years in monastery, and it was really lovely for me to do that. I loved that time. But what happened then when I went to Thailand and had all this time practicing alone in my little huts? The first time it happened, I realized I'd never practiced alone that intensively. I'd sat alone, you know, at home sometimes before the monastery, but and I discovered how much I had depended on the group for the support and the momentum of practice for the discipline. And it was a whole different game to find the discipline to practice when no one was watching and no one was there to support me. It was all had to depend on my own understanding, my own dedication, my own discipline. And I had to find that within me to keep it up and to keep on the practice. And it's quite something to practice, you know, all day long and to make that keep that discipline going. And that was part of the value for me, was to grapple with that sense of inner discipline myself and slowly be able to find it for myself so that I have, hopefully still have, the discipline to go and spend a month basically alone, sitting in jungle, the only company being the monkeys jumping on the roof. So those are my thoughts about the wilderness. It's part of our tradition, and you can think about it a little bit, and maybe it inspires you to do something like that. Your thoughts, your questions, comments? We have five minutes or so. Pesha. Yeah.
And it feels like it's the right thing to ask. So I will turn around, go back, and I'll walk in Shoreline Park or someplace where I'm uncomfortable. So I'm not really facing fear. But on the other hand, maybe it's wise. The fear might be part of wisdom.
It could be. And I think it could well be, and I'm not the one to tell you otherwise. But I do know that human beings have a tremendous capacity for fear of imaginary things. Mm-hmm. Tremendous capacity. Little children afraid of the, you know, monsters in the closet and under their bed, and you know, all kinds of things. So you know, do we have to always be afraid? You know, the wilderness, and fear has a lot to do with also with familiarity. So someone who's like spent a lot of time in the wilderness is quite comfortable in it. Someone who doesn't know it for various reasons is very frightened. My son, when he was 3 years old, we lived up in the woods of the Skyline, and he was terrified of the woods, absolutely terrified. I would sometimes carry him into the woods, and he would start shaking. So we wouldn't go in the woods with him. And so I don't know what that was about, but I know in my own situation that as I get familiarity in places I'm afraid of initially, as I kind of get a sense of the territory, know how to take care of myself in the area, then I don't feel afraid anymore. And there are times when I'm not, you know, times when things are not so frightening as my imagination tells me to. And sometimes things are frightening. And it's very, very valuable to learn to have the capacity, even when we're afraid, not to be run by the fear, not to be controlled by the fear. Sometimes we're afraid by situations where maybe it's healthy to be afraid, maybe it's not healthy to be afraid, but we still have to be in that situation. We don't have the luxury to turn away. There's a lot of people in the world who aren't privileged in the way many of us are here are, who fear is a daily part of their life experience. And our circumstances can change very radically, very quickly, and end up in situations where we can't just simply go to Shoreline to go hiking. And if we've never kind of been on the edges of our fear and explored it and learned how to develop the patience, the concentration to, in a sense, override it or see it clearly or not make mistakes because of it, then we might end up making mistakes. So I definitely think there's a place for pushing the edges of fear, but hopefully do it in the wise ways. And I know people who choose, the woman who went into the woods in Vajrapani to be at, you know, I think she had the sense or the understanding this was not a dangerous place for her to be. And I don't think it was dangerous. I mean, there is a mountain lion, there are rattlesnakes up there, but the chances of encountering one are pretty slim. And I think she knew that logically there was no fear, and she felt the fear was, in a sense, illogical, and it was something she wanted to deal with and contend with. So all kinds of places of fear. I once woke up. I put my sleeping bag down once, and another situation where it was dark, and I just put it down to sleep under a bush someplace, and woke up in the morning to find out that I was sleeping on top of a grave in a cemetery. And a lot of people would be afraid to sleep in the cemetery, and maybe I would be now if I knew it, if I'd known it, but I didn't know it. So there's a lot in the suttas, in the discourses, and in the Thai tradition, there's a lot of emphasis on developing fearlessness and working with fear and finding where to be, how to, you know, not to be afraid. And there's a lot of things come into play, learning how to be fearless. And some of it has to do with very deep-seated attachments. So deep, as, for example, is our attachment to being alive. That deep. So Ajahn Chah sitting there, you know, I'll die anyway. And, you know, it's never reasonable to tell people, you know, go out and face those deepest fears. But there are, you know, as instructions. But there are individuals who take it on themselves to really, you know, they're that serious about what they're doing. They're that serious about kind of plunging into the depth of the Dharma, that they'll take it to those extremes. Is that okay, an answer? What do you think of that answer? Objections? Some other things? Fear of public speaking is considered worse than being almost anything. So you face that fear. No. Most common.
You can be afraid just walking down the block in the city much more. So if you're in the woods and you're afraid because it's unfamiliar, I think it helps to remember that really murders and things happen more often in the city.
Yeah. Yes, please. Encountering loneliness. I don't think I talk about it so much myself. I know there are people who have given Dharma talks on that topic. But I think that's something I've encountered. But do you want to ask a question?
No, I was just curious if the monks go out in the woods, if they ever talk about, being lonely or fast, lonely or things.
Probably. Nothing comes to mind right now. I had to deal with that when I was in my cabin by myself. Anyway, one of the Spirit Rock teachers talks about going and spending a month in a cabin someplace. And that came up really big for him, was loneliness. And it's quite reasonable that loneliness would come up in that kind of situation. And some people choose to go into that environment in order to look their loneliness right in the face, right in the eye, to really deal with it and come to terms with it. It can be very frightening, and it can make a person nauseous to deal with it, look at their loneliness and rawly and directly. But it's valuable because I believe that if we don't have the capacity to be alone, we don't really have the capacity to be together with others in really wise ways and loving ways also. The two go, in my mind at least, the two go very closely together. Yeah?
I'm afraid of dogs. What would you suggest?
Yeah, she's afraid of dogs. And what would I suggest? What would you like me to suggest?
Well, maybe I like to walk, and maybe when I see a dog coming along with its owner, I always look at to see how they have them grabbed correctly or not, or tightly. I usually I don't pass them. Get off the sidewalk and let them go by or something.
So she looks at the cues, subtle cues, whether how tightly they're holding the leash. And I guess if the leash is really held tightly, then she's, the cues are such that maybe she can't be sure.
And I don't know if I should look at the dog or not look at the dog, or if I should, Should you look at the dog?
Should you look at the dog?
Should you have eye contact with the dog?
I think my opinion is that it's a situation of requires great mindfulness, attentiveness, being in the present moment, and taking in all the cues you can. And for some dogs, you want to look at them, and some dogs you want to avoid eye contact, some dogs you want to be close and friendly, and some dogs you want to, give them a wide berth. And each dog is different, and you have to have the presence of mind to kind of psych it out. And if you're in doubt, give a dog a wide berth. So that's. So the first thought that occurred to me when you said this was, spend time on dogs. Get to know dogs really well. Become a dog whisperer. My wife has a book called Baby Whisperer. So thank you all very much.